Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Has America spoiled itself rotten? Not only is modern society set up to give us exactly what we want as soon as we want it, in many ways our economy depends on a sufficient number of us defining ourselves according to what we consume. At the same time, corporations are built around delivering short-term infusions of cash to investors by creating insatiable consumer demand, and politicians are ever more reluctant to advocate for the kind of patient investments of time, energy, or taxpayer dollars that led to some of the greatest achievements in our past and might put us back on a path toward a stable and sustainable future. Journalist Paul Roberts looks at how we arrived here in his new book, The Impulse Society, America in the Age of Instant Gratification. Paul, welcome to Think.
Chris, it's great to be here. Thanks.
You point out that our economic system routinely mistakes what we want for what we need. How did we get here when, by all accounts, Americans so openly embraced the sacrifices necessary to, say, win the Second World War?
Well, I mean, you know, really, we're talking about the consequences of our success, you know. That's sort of the paradox here. You know, we've spent the last couple of centuries developing a system that is better and better and more efficient at delivering rapid gratification. And we've reached a point now where we're so good at it that we focus now just on what we want and not what we need. And want, there's nothing wrong with want inherently. It's just that wants tend to be short-term and sort of focused on me, and that's no basis to run a society.
One shift, in terms of the shift in our technology, cost aside, it is simply easier now to acquire quite literally anything under the sun that we might wish for.
Oh, right. So you've really put your finger on sort of the, what's the difference between now and, say, 50 years ago? You know, and really it's two things. It's technology that allows us to move so quickly in terms of decision-making, deciding to gratify something, that we can almost forget, at least temporarily, that any of the consequences. You know, so a classic example would be credit cards or, say, credit purchase online. You know, you can hit the buy now button so easily that you may not even remember that you made the purchase until it shows up 2 days later on your doorstep. So there's that issue. And I think that, you know, combined with that is this sort of ideological shift we went through a couple decades ago, really the Reagan Revolution, where we said, look, you know, governments don't do a good job planning economies. Let's turn that over to the marketplace. The marketplace is much more efficient. It's actually much smarter. And that's really the way to restore prosperity. And it was sort of that, you know, bottom line mentality combined with this hyper-fast technology that really brought us to the point where we are now.
The point we are now where we sometimes conflate personal identity with economic activity.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was, I mean, and that's, you know, that's sort of going back to the age of Mad Men. I mean, we sort of understood nearly a century ago that you couldn't run a consumer economy simply based on what people need. You had to sort of step it up to the next level where people were acquiring not just, you know, the tools for material life, but, you know, they needed identity, they needed better status, they needed the satisfaction of having the nicest whatever. And as soon as that had sort of caught on, then the economy really had no limit, because these sorts of immaterial desires, these aspirations, they're infinite. I mean, you can never be fully satisfied in terms of your status. And so there's sort of this bottomless nature to the economy at that point.
And it goes faster and faster, and yet we don't seem to notice, you know, as we're chasing down the next, you know, it pair of shoes or automobile or, you know, something for the house or whatever experience even that we pay for. The gratification doesn't last, but we keep thinking the next thing will do it.
Right. And I think that, you know, that's sort of been the model, you know, for the last half century. But I think, you know, I suppose the good news is that we are sort of gradually recognizing that that doesn't work. The satisfaction isn't lasting. So on a personal level, it's you know, not fulfilling. And then we, you know, have had a couple decades to look at the way that sort of activity plays out on the environment, on the economy, on the political scene. So I think there's a lot of dissatisfaction with that model and a lot of anxiety. We're just not exactly sure what to do now. You know, we built this system that is so focused on the here and the now and the me that it makes it very hard to care about the future. Well, now we're seeing what happens when you stop paying attention to the future. And so we're asking, okay, how do we sort of unwind this?
The anxiety thing is really interesting, and it's something that you deal with in the book. This idea that we have created what we thought would be a utopia, and all it's really done is remind us frequently that this is not going to be sustainable, it can't work forever, it doesn't make us happy, and yet it doesn't seem that most of us can figure a way out of this.
Yeah, I think that you have, you know, I suppose it was sort of a utopia that we thought we were creating. Really, what we thought we were doing was sort of empowering the individual. I mean, that's the sort of the explicit objective as the consumer economy is emerging, you know, just over a century ago. I mean, if you look at Henry Ford, he finds a way to mass produce cheap transportation, and this empowers the individual, you know, to get where you want to go faster. To do it independently. You didn't have to wait for, you know, your father to saddle up the horse. You didn't have to wait for a train. You didn't have to ask permission. You just got in your car and went. And so there's this massive measure of individual freedom that shows up with these sorts of technologies, the car being, you know, a classic example. But right away, you start realizing, well, geez, if you don't have to ask permission to go somewhere, then you've sort of severed some social connections. And so there's costs here. And I think that's what we're in the midst of right now is we have so much individual capability today. We can do so much. We can control so much of our lives, you know, whether we're talking about food, fashion, entertainment, transportation. There's this sense that we're sort of limitless and that we don't need to ask anyone's permission or do anything in accordance with someone else. And that's been, you know, fantastic from an individual standpoint. But if you believe that human happiness, at least sustainable happiness, has to do with our connections with community, with our neighbors, with our families, with broader society, then you have to find a way to balance that individual power and consider its impacts. And I think that's really where we're at right now. It's how do we make that balance?
I was really struck by that a couple of weeks ago. I had car trouble for 2 days, right? And so first of all, I realized how convenient it is to have my own vehicle to get to and from work and everywhere all over town. When I didn't have that, you're absolutely right. The first thing I did was ask my husband for a ride. Then I asked a coworker for a ride. And you ultimately have to depend more on people. And you have these little conversations that you wouldn't have had otherwise.
Right. So, yeah. So, I mean, you can see when you're sort of forced to step back from, I mean, God forbid your smartphone doesn't work. So maybe you have to have a conversation with somebody, you know, I mean, and these are almost cliche to talk about because there is this movement out there to unplug and to sort of rediscover, you know, face-to-face human contact. Wow, what's that about? So we sort of get that. I think what we have to acknowledge in that is that it's no fun to give up that personal freedom. I mean, you yourself, maybe you had some great conversations with people, but it's a bummer to lose that mobility.
Sure.
And to lose the capacity to just sort of go when you want to go. So these are real considerations. And it's no surprise that Americans or anyone else who's attained this level of individual empowerment, it's no surprise that we're hyper reluctant to give it up. I think you have to begin by persuasively making the case that there are consequences and that these consequences actually have individual costs down the road. So one thing we have to do is sort of relearn the practice of looking down the road. And that's something that our economy has done a real good job of sort of making it seem, you know, that it's not necessary to look down the road. You know, so many of the consumer propositions out there, the consequence is separated from the immediate reward.
Buy now, pay later.
Exactly. And it's in everything. It's in the food we eat. It's in most of the pleasures. The consequence is sort of made so it's basically rendered invisible. And, you know, that it makes it tough then as an individual to sort of really firmly believe that there are consequences. And as a culture, we don't like to really talk about those.
Paul, how has the balance of goods and services, wants and needs produced by our industries shifted over time?
Well, I mean, you know, in a basic way, we went from a producer economy, that is an economy where most of what we needed ourselves. We purchased raw ingredients, you know, and we then produced something. We've switched from that to a consumer economy where we bought nearly everything pre-made. So that's been, you know, a really big shift. And that's, you know, been sort of the defining shift for the last century. I think there are part of that, there are, you know, separate sort of sub-shifts. I mean, certainly one would be the move from manufacturing to a service economy. And with that, sort of the lower wage structure that came with it. And in many ways, the different work structure, the fact that people are, you know, working one or two or three jobs as opposed to one job, the lack of sort of power that employees have that's come along with that. So that's, I think, an important shift. I think probably last and most recently, the digital shift, you know, even though we're in many cases less well off and our wages are flattening, and we no longer have the sort of prosperity that in conventional terms that we used to have, we've got so many options online that in terms of the hours that you have in the day and the amusement that you can find, we're in many ways richer than we were. So I think that's a critical shift because it's both been a great benefit, but it's also been one of the things I think that keeps people from seeing, you know, the reality of their situation.
What's the relationship between our expectation of instant gratification and the way we are treated as consumers wherever we go? That word is used in a way that is not ironic and it's unabashed. You know, when you say, are you, you know, you sign up online for something and then they say, do you want consumer level service or, you know, business level service? We're called consumers openly by the company selling to us.
Right. And there, you know, the sort of the instant distinction is that if you're a consumer level service, you're probably not going to want to pay for like super fast internet connection or whatever the service is. I think more broadly, I think the idea is that if you're a consumer, your decisions aren't necessarily going to be rational. I mean, if you're a business and you're making a decision about buying a product or raw material, you've presumably penciled everything out so that your costs are not going to interfere with your profits. And you've sort of looked ahead a little bit to see how this is all going to play out. The consumer is sort of 180 degrees opposite. The consumer is simply saying, how does this feel now? Or at least that's the sort of the ideal of the consumer. And so, yes, we have sort of allowed ourselves to be corralled into this sort of image of children, you know, who can't be counted on to take care of their own affairs, who will constantly screw up, are very short-term, very self-centered, and thank goodness for the business customers who are sort of minding the store, at least, you know, that's the image. But it turns out that even the business customers can be just as sort of irrational.
And increasingly now, although we have unlimited choices, our exposure to those choices is driven by these computer algorithms that sort of assume they know what we will need.
Right. And that's been interesting, too, because, you know, clearly we're in the opening stages of that, you know, the personalization of the economy. And it still makes a lot of mistakes when you see like the recommendations that some of these websites make for it. It's like, no, I'm not interested in a book about like, you know, Nazi paraphernalia. But but it's getting better and better. And, you know, you keep reading these stories like with the one with Target, the retail store a few years ago, where their data mining was getting so efficient that they were able to predict that one of their customers, a teenager, was pregnant even before her family knew. And so, you know, we're seeing that level of personalization, and we can certainly talk about this in a minute, but it's, you know, that has benefits, all sorts of positive potential, but it also has a lot of negative side effects as well.
Journalist Paul Roberts is my guest. His new book is called The Impulse Society, America in the Age of Instant Gratification. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Paul Roberts. His new book is called The Impulse Society, America in the Age of Instant Gratification. You can get on the line to join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Paul, before the break, you brought up the idea that, you know, this definition of ourselves as consumers has certainly some benefits, but also some trade-offs, one of which is the really contribution that market segmentation makes to social divisions. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the you know, great sort of triumphs of the sort of advanced consumer economy is that, you know, markets can be broken down to the level of the individual preference, you know, so your likes and dislikes. So we can basically customize. And this shows up everywhere. I mean, you go to a supermarket, there are, you know, 50,000 different items in that supermarket, you know, about 10 times the amount that were there 3 decades ago. And that vast variety, those choices, that full spectrum of choices lets you as the consumer really tailor your food choices. You can pretty much build a menu, a pantry that fits your, you know, everything from your specific dietary needs to the mood you happen to be into. And that potential for customization exists across the economy, and it's getting more and more so, you know, as the digital realm becomes more sophisticated. So on the one hand, you get this fantastic capacity to, you know, tailor the consumer experience precisely like you want it. And who wouldn't want that? You know, and this you see this in things like being able to move to a neighborhood where people think like you and share your political views, or you can tune into a news channel where people share your views on President Obama. You can, you know, and so across the everywhere in the economy, you can make those sorts of distinctions, and that's great. On the other hand, in the process of personalizing our consuming experience, we're at risk of losing the diversity that I think most people would agree is essential for a vibrant, you know, civic culture. If you're only in a neighborhood where people all agree with you politically, then that's only going to encourage, you know, your political view. It's never going to cause you or to say question whether your stance on the issues needs to be reconsidered. And you know, we're seeing that sort of segmentation become more and more extreme. And in some cases, it doesn't matter. I mean, if you're hanging out with people who only like, you know, chocolate milk for breakfast, it's probably not going to be, you know, hugely negative in terms of its impact on America. But on the other hand, if you're only hearing the same political views day after day, and then you're asked by a politician to, say, make a compromise, why would you even consider a compromise if you haven't been, you know, if you haven't been hearing about compromise in your day-to-day life?
Let's talk about the politicians themselves. I've heard interesting arguments that, say, two-year congressional terms essentially keep representatives in, like, perpetual campaign mode, and they're focused on the short term rather than the long term. But, of course, we've had those terms for a very long time now. What is so different today that causes our elected leaders to focus on these shorter cycles rather than planning for projects that might be complete long after they're out of office?
Well, I mean, part of it is, you know, television really, really transformed things. You know, back in the 70s, it really made it important to be able to raise a lot of money because TV is so expensive. And since you need to raise a lot of money, fundraising is going to be sort of a constant. So, I mean, these congressional reps, from the moment they enter office, they spend hours every day. I read somewhere like 4 or 5 hours a day raising funds. So there's that issue. I think at the same time, there's been a shift in the political culture where voters are sort of less and less willing to take the time to parse issues. We mostly want to be fed issues sort of as efficiently and easily and as painlessly as we get everything else. We expect to have issues tailored to us. You know, I mean, the problem is that there's carryover from the consumer market, and we're accustomed to customization there. So why would we want anything differently in our political lives? So because now politicians are forced to tailor issues to specific constituencies, and they're able to do that now with big data, you know, they can micro-target, they call it, that also costs money. So the market is sort of transforming the political culture into a copy of the financial market, essentially, where you have to make a huge investments and you're looking for a quick return on your investment. And as soon as that mentality enters the picture, then it is continuous, because in the same way that you'd never expect a company to stop marketing, to stop trying to turn a profit, we now no longer expect our politicians to sort of stop trying to get reelected.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now with Pete in Arlington. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Chris. Very interesting topic this morning. Before I get to my question, I would like to share with you and your guests something that I heard many, many years ago that I think is a pretty succinct way of summing up the multifaceted dilemma that your guest is speaking about. It was a definition of economic prosperity. And the definition of economic prosperity was a condition in which the citizenry spends a lot of money they don't really have to buy a lot of things they don't really want to impress a lot of people they don't really like. And I think there's much truth to that. Hmm. Now on to my question. In my lifetime, and I'll soon turn 74, and I was in a generation that grew up admiring and revering the men and women who fought and won the Second World War, the greatest generation. It seems like over the years, the only time that we've come together as a company, as a country, when there was a war or something that you might call the moral equivalent of war. Unfortunately, the moral equivalent of war has a rather whiny-sounding acronym of MEOW. But my question is, where are the leaders, where are the principles, where are the whatever to bring back a sense of national community and a commitment to common good that transcends the very circumstances that you're so eloquently describing? And I'll take my question off the air, and thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
Well, that was a great set of questions, Pete, and a great observation. I think that you really, you hit the nail on the head. There was a time, in the not so distant past when we were more accustomed to thinking in national terms, to thinking of ourselves as at least a partly unified people. And, the question is, what happened to that and how do we restore it? I think one of the problems is that we've gotten so used to sort of thinking there has to be an emergency, a crisis, and we've got to use that crisis to sort of recover and rediscover our national unity. But that in itself, that message has been so commodified and commercialized that we completely distrust it. We feel we're being manipulated. So when we have a war, we're not really sure how we're supposed to feel about it. There are so many competing messages. So there's that issue. I think the other issue is that although national unity to some degree is essential, and we've lost a lot of that and it costs us, I think that we may focus too much on trying to restore that, and that really where the rubber is going to hit the road is in sort of at a local level. And because that is really where people are forced to sort of confront who they're becoming and confront the consequences of their choices, in the way that those choices affect their neighbors or the rest of the people in town. And it's in that interaction and it's in that sort of reciprocation that people sort of, their impulses are, you're forced to temper them. And that's where I have, the greatest really optimism is seeing so much sort of excitement over local initiatives, because I think people are sort of getting it at the very least a gut level that that's where this has to happen. I mean, it starts from the ground up. Eventually the national culture will follow. But I don't think that you can start from a national, from the top down and have, some eloquent leaders say, we need to be more unified, and then hope that filters down to the street level. It has to start at the level of the street. And, again, that's where I'm really encouraged, because it is starting. It's, these efforts are, they're fragmented in some cases. They're halting. But they're building. I mean, look at the local food movement. This is essentially people have decided that the existing model, the industrial food system, is not adequate for a whole host of reasons. And they're recognizing that what they want is, let's say, they want to know more about where their food is produced. But in doing that, they realize they've got to establish relationships with the producers. And this is something entirely new for many people, So you establish this relationship, and all of a sudden, this changes your expectation about how food should be produced, how much it should cost, how quickly you should expect it to be prepared. A whole host of I think, positive reactions occur. And that may not have been your initial sort of point. You may just have wanted strawberries that tasted like strawberries and not like wood. But it's those sorts of connections, I think, that are going to bring about the kinds of changes that I think people at a gut level are really looking for.
When and how did cooperation start to look like weakness from the viewpoint of American culture?
I think we've always struggled with cooperation versus sort of individualism in this country. I mean, really, you know, as we were defining ourselves centuries ago, we were fighting to sort of throw off the yoke of European culture, and specifically the sort of the hierarchies that came along with European culture, that the status of, you know, where you were born, you know, were you a good, you know, did you come from a good family? Did you belong to the right religion, the right political party? We really decided that you could throw that off and reinvent yourself. And this is an essential part of creating the American sort of character in the 19th century. We always struggled with, okay, so what does that mean in terms of our ability to come together politically, you know, to come together collectively to do things that need to be done collectively? And, you know, sometimes we'd have large events that would force it on us, you know, the Second World War, the Depression. But we've always struggled with it. I think that what has happened more recently is that you were forced to come together simply because you had to depend on your neighbors, that you didn't have the capacity to do things by yourself. You wanted to build a barn. I mean, this is the cliche example. You needed help. Today, you just buy the barn, you know, or some technological capacity allows you to have the thing without relying on anyone. And more the rationale for cooperation recedes. And then when we find ourselves suddenly needing to cooperate, we, in many cases, have lost the skills to cooperate. I mean, it takes skill. You know, there are social skills required to work with your neighbors in a sort of a peaceful and sustainable way. I mean, we used to have rules about the things you'd talk about at dinner. You couldn't talk about politics or religion. And there was a good reason for that, because the dinner party could erupt. It could collapse in a fight. So there were rules about how you interacted. And in many cases, we've lost those. I mean, now people will sit on a bus and tell a total stranger everything about themselves. You just didn't do that in the past because you wanted to reserve some of yourself for, you know, when you needed to. You didn't want necessarily everyone to know all that stuff about you. So I think rediscovering some of these social skills for cooperation is probably one of the first steps to moving, you know, away from this impulse society that we're stuck in.
Let's talk about the third leg of this stool, which is corporate America and businesses. We've had businesses for a very long time. Their purpose has always been to earn a profit, whether for shareholders or simply for the, you know, small business owner. But today, it seems there are a lot of kind of perverse incentives in the way we do business. And one example that you give in the book is, in the healthcare system, a sick patient is ultimately much more valuable than a healthy one.
Right, and this is sort of a, you know, this observation has been around for a while, and it's really one of the sadder, you know, sort of understandings of our healthcare system. It's that, you know, a person who takes good care of themselves, who practices preventive care, exercises, eats right, doesn't smoke, is ultimately worth less to healthcare providers because there's fewer services to offer. And, you know, in the same way, you can kind of step back, you can expand that idea. So a family that, say, you know, a family with kids that hangs out, does a lot of, you know, plays together, goes for walks, reads books in the evening, has meals at home. That family is worth a lot less to the economy than one that's entirely dysfunctional, you know, that where the family members retire for their own little activities and they eat alone and maybe they even get divorced, because then you'll need a new set of, you know, you need a new house and a new set of dishes. So, you know, it's the economy didn't make that happen, but you can see that the economy benefits from that. And so those incentives are already in place. And then it just, you know, you kind of step back and you say that paradigm is the dominant paradigm. And No one asked it to be here, but it's sort of what happens when you let the market, set the terms. And that's what we've done. I mean, that's really been, I think, the sort of the saddest consequence of this, of the, you know, financial revolution that we had 3 decades ago. We essentially said the market knows what it's doing. It's much more efficient. We're going to let the market set the terms. We're going to let the market determine which values are important. And this is what happens.
How did it become so toxic to even raise the possibility that there are things about capitalism that are not perfect?
I mean, that's the trillion-dollar question, isn't it? You know, I mean, it's been toxic from the moment that Marx and Engels brought this up. I mean, first of all, capitalism has proven to be the most durable form of sort of economic organization there is. And any time governments attempt to sort of wade in and impose an alternative, it almost invariably screws up. Mm-hmm. So there is that, you know, rather large bit of evidence to support those, you know, people who refuse to hear any alternative to capitalism. I think the other problem is that if you suggest an alternative to capitalism, you're implicitly endorsing a curb on the freedom of the individual, and that's no one likes to think about that. You know, I mean, as much as we complain about the 1%, and as obvious as the problems that are coming from inequality are, when it comes down to it, few of us are willing to give up the idea that we too might score big. You know, it's really tough. So I think that it's, you know, we're at that paradoxical point where we recognize that the market doesn't always take us in the best place. And yet, you know, for society, we recognize that. But on an individual level, we're still not sure if we're quite ready to give up the sort of ideal of individual freedom and advancement. And that's really one of the conversations we need to start having, and it's one we're afraid to.
Journalist Paul Roberts is my guest. We're talking about his new book, The Impulse Society, America in the Age of Instant Gratification. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send an instant tweet to me at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Paul Roberts. His new book is called The Impulse Society, America in the Age of Instant Gratification. You can call us at 1-800-933-5372. I was thinking about this, Paul, as we watch the developing world coming closer and closer to Western levels of wealth and affluence and access to cash. To what extent will they be looking to the United States as a model for what this should look like? And to what extent might that be mitigated by the fact that a number of these countries still have much more kind of collectivist cultures in that they think about how their actions will involve the entire classroom or the entire family or the entire neighborhood to a greater extent than ever has been the case in the United States?
Well, that's a complicated question. I mean, I think you have to recognize the possibility that that more collective and cooperative social attitude may itself be sort of a reflection of where those countries are economically. A sociologist named Ronald Engelhardt at the University of Michigan, you know, discovered that as societies get wealthier, their individuals tend to become less collectivist in their outlook, much more individualist. And that seems to hold across cultures. So it may be that as these countries become wealthier, assuming they do, because that's a big, you know, that isn't a certainty by any means, that they may lose some of that traditional collectivist, you know, attitude. And again, the collectivist attitude really is in many ways driven by economic necessity. So if they go through the same economic sort of evolution and their individual citizens have more, you know, individual power, they could lose that. So I think there's that. I think that they're watching the United States and have for a long time, and they're studying us, and they're sort of deciding what parts of our culture they like and what parts they don't. So it's not as if they're embracing the whole package, you know, just taking the whole thing without, you know, asking questions about it. And I think the last thing is that we ourselves are really having to rethink that culture. I mean, we've talked a little bit about people's dissatisfaction and anxiety. And I think a lot of that is being driven by, you know, I mean, when you and I were little, I'm assuming, you know, in your case, my mom and parents spent a lot of time trying to instill values, certain values. And there were things like you have to be patient, you have to be disciplined and be willing to work through, you know, tough times. You have to be willing to think of people other than just yourself, you know, even if just temporarily. And these were sort of the values that were just standard, and they're presumably the values that we teach our own kids. And yet those aren't the values that the culture, that the consumer culture values. They're not the values that the corporate culture seems to value either. So there's a tension, I think, in a lot of people because we recognize the gap between what should be there and what we know, the values we know are essential for a culture that works. There's a tension between that and what's actually out there. And I think that really bothers a lot of people. And I think it's the source of a lot of the disquiet we have. But it's also, I think, the source of a lot of, you know, potential for change. So, you know, I think that we're at a point now where we're asking ourselves, where do we want to go? I mean, you know, let's say, look at this new product, Amazon's new phone. It's called the Fire. And I don't know how familiar you are with it, but one of the main selling points, presumably, is that you can scan a product and it will identify it instantly and take you to a link where you can buy it on Amazon, you know, presumably for a discount. Now, that's great, but I mean, what's that for? That's for showrooming, right? Hmm. This practice where you go into another store and you buy the product online cheaper, and you basically use the store's showroom, its employees, you know, but you don't add to its bottom line. And you think about that. I mean, it's a sort of a and Amazon's not the only one here. I mean, you know, you can get showrooming apps on any phone, but it's becoming this sort of new model. And think about it. What that means is that you're going to walk into a store and you're going to ask a person, hey, where is your plasma? You know, where's your plasma screen TVs? Thanks. I'm going to buy this plasma screen from Amazon or from wherever, and I'm going to basically put you out of a job. So there's this whole sort of antisocial element inherent in this technology. It allows you to sort of seek your own sort of self-interest at someone else's expense, and it sort of turns it into sort of a cultural norm. It'll become the normal thing to do. So there's that element of it. At the same time, it's pretty short-term because if we're all doing this and we're all showrooming, then at some point showrooms can't survive because if we're not actually buying from Target or, you know, JCPenney's, they will no longer be able to support showrooms. So the very sort of we'll be basically killing the goose that lays the golden eggs. And, you know, then the phone becomes good for what? Taking a selfie of yourself standing in front of a closed store, right?
Right.
So it's inherent in that sort of innovative technology is this very short-term outlook. And I'm afraid that's become really standard in our innovation and in our sort of expectation, our consumer culture. People look at that and I think they're finally realizing, wow, you know, that's lame. I mean, why would I want to do that? I mean, I can see why I would want to at a sort of an instinctual self-preservation level. But how could I do that to a person I might know at the store? And what's going to happen a year from now? You know, so that's why it's so encouraging to see things like independent bookstores, which were supposed to be rendered extinct by the chains and by Amazon, by ebooks. In fact, they're thriving. You know, over the past 5 years, we've actually seen the number of indies growing each year. And, you know, that has to do with a lot of things. Part of it's, you know, there's the saturation of the ebook market. The big chains like Barnes & Noble and Borders have stumbled and really, and also the indies themselves have done a good job of marketing. But there's an element. If you talk to the bookstore owners themselves, they'll tell you that there's a real element here where consumers themselves are rediscovering that the book world is about more than just massive discounts and instant delivery. You know, there is an intangible value at these small bookstores. That's where people collect. It's where sometimes there's political gatherings. It's where there are cultural events. There's a center or a capacity to be a center of a neighborhood at these shops that people are recognizing, wow, that's something that I want to preserve. You know, I didn't realize that I would miss that, and that can't be duplicated online, or at least not in the same way, and that's worth something. And you know, that's a small dent, right? I mean, that's just a drop in the bucket when we look at what's happening to the entire economy. But it does suggest that consumers aren't just, you know, impulsive robots, that we certainly respond to all these incentives and we've moved very far in a direction that a lot of us are worried about. But we have a capacity to sort of look back and say, whoa, this isn't exactly where I thought I was going. And it's certainly not where I want to be. And it's time to make a change.
And I suppose it's easier to do that now if we decide this is important to us than after these kinds of businesses that we think we value go completely extinct.
Yeah, and exactly. So it would be good. It was fortunate for the indie bookstores and for all the people that enjoy them that this recognition occurred, you know, 5 years ago as opposed to 15 years from now. And we're discussing indie bookstores in some class on campus when we're talking about business forms that no longer exist. Yes, it's absolutely the case that people need to look around now and sort of ask, I'm pressing this button. What are the ramifications? You know, you're playing chess. You're about to make a move. You've got your finger on the piece. You're looking around. What am I forgetting here? That's sort of the mindset that I've begun to adopt in my sort of day-to-day activities. And I sort of want to encourage other people to at least consider that nothing is as it seems. You know, none of the sort of consumer propositions out there come with full disclosure. They don't tell you all the economic sort of backstory that goes on to make it possible to sell you, you know, a chicken sandwich for a buck. You know, they don't tell you the political maneuvers that had to be gone through. They don't tell you what this means, you know, for social conditions for the workers that are, you know, skinning the chicken. I mean, all of that is hidden away, and you can assume that you're only getting a small part of the story, or at least that's what's being given to you. You need to dig further. And that's why when you've got your finger on that chess piece, you really do need to look around and sort of make that part of your mode, part of your mindset.
Did you struggle at all? Forgive me for pushing back a little bit, but did you struggle with the fact that your book is available on Amazon?
Well, I mean, absolutely. I mean, that question is sort of multi-tiered. There's this whole battle that Amazon's now having with Hachette, the publisher, right, over who gets what share of the profits. You know, Amazon has created this model where it's pushed the prices down, and that's been great for consumers, but now we've got to divide up that profit. What's the remaining profit? So there's a big debate about who should get that, the traditional publishers or Amazon. And then there's the issue that I think you're raising, which is, what do we do about the fact that people could turn around and buy my book right away, you know, which would be great. And it'd be great if they, you know, put a nice review up there. That'd be great. But at the same time, what's that doing to an independent bookstore? And what is that doing to the mindset? I mean, it's sort of, you know, the more that you buy on Amazon or anywhere, the more you're sort of reinforcing an idea of having things instantly. And if that is one of the things what we've identified is somewhat suspect, then absolutely, it's a paradox. We're in an economy that rewards that sort of behavior, and yet we're trying to sort of step out of it without crashing the economy, whether we're talking about crashing it on a personal level or more broadly. So, yeah, it is. It's tough. It's a dilemma. You know, you can't afford to turn your back on it completely, but you'd like to change the way it operates.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Matt on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Matt.
Yes, hi. How are you? I, of course, love your show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having all these great people on.
Welcome.
I love the subject. I've had a retail store for about 35 years, and I would say in the last 25 years, I've seen mostly a demand for more bang for less buck. whatever it takes to get a bigger basket or a bigger dress or a better whatever. It just, I want a better value on it, though. So it mostly led to imports, you know, say from China or from around the world. And I would say in the last 5 years, we've done some experimenting where we have made local up front of our store, and they go through it as they go to the back. And I'm watching people care a lot more about where their money's going and get more satisfaction out of possibly spending a little bit more money, say, for a pair of earrings, but it's made local, has more character, let's say. So I would say in the last 2 years, I've seen a significant increase in how many people would support the made local. So I'm seeing kind of a more of a conscientiousness behind purchasing now that I didn't see 5 years ago or even 3 years ago.
Sounds like a hopeful sign, Paul Roberts. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's encouraging. You know, if people have a set amount to spend and they're really not after anything they need, then why not get the pleasure of you know, supporting local producers? You know, I mean, I think that's fantastic. I think also you have to consider that, you know, in the post-recession period, people are really asking about the sustainability of an economic model that, you know, gets more and more of its stuff from overseas. So people are sort of asking all these questions, and maybe an emphasis, a greater emphasis on local is one of the answers. But more broadly, it's encouraging to hear that people are sort of considering that, because there's always been this sort of the cynical view that people shop, it's pocketbook, 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 and they only are looking for value, and they want, like Matt was saying, bigger bang for the buck, and everything else is just going to be sort of the thing you do to make yourself feel better, so that you spend the last dollar of your, you know, $100 shopping budget on a local thing and say, hey, I'm sort of, you know, I did the right thing. But maybe that's not the case. You know, maybe we're willing to spend a little more, and to maybe, and more importantly, to think a little bit more about what we're spending on, what the ramifications are, and then, you know, ideally you roll that out, you know, to other areas of your life, politics and you know, the kind of an education, and you know, who knows? I think we're already seeing change. I think we're already seeing an awareness that the status quo doesn't work. Especially among younger people. I mean, there's a lot of complaining about this younger generation. Oh, they don't vote, you know. Well, they participate politically. They're very politically aware. They're not as cynical as you'd expect, despite the fact they grew up in the recession and they watched political paralysis. They are hungry for something new. And I think that our generation, I think what is really incumbent on us is sort of getting out of their way, you know. We are so cynical, I think, most of us. And that really colors our capacity to see solutions. They haven't reach that level of cynicism yet, and they won't if we can leave them alone long enough to let them sort of find their own way. I think that's really one of the first steps in the right direction.
The new book by journalist Paul Roberts is called The Impulse Society, America in the Age of Instant Gratification. Paul, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. We had help on the phones today from Christina Ulsh and Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.